6 years ago, the Irish government introduced a tax on plastic bags, which decreased their use by more than 90% and actually made it uncool to be seen carrying them. However, while you probably noticed a lot more cloth bags in New York, plastic bags are still the norm here. Why do certain environmental trends catch on in some places but not others? And how many people need to adopt these green habits for them to actually make a difference? Laura Haight, a senior environmental associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group in Albany, looks at these trends on a local level, and Alex Steffen, executive editor of worldchanging.com, takes a more global view as editor of the book World Changing, a user's guide for the 21st century, which is published by Abrams. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to the show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, why did Ireland place a tax on the bag?
Well, I think it's part of a broader trend that we're seeing where people are realizing that there are all sorts of small strategic interventions that local governments can make, or national governments even can make, that knock off things that are particularly egregious environmental problems without really causing any real, economic harm or difficulty in people's day-to-day lives. We've also seen plastic bag bans in places like San Francisco here in the U.S., but also the entire nation of China is moving away from plastic bags.
And Bangladesh and Rwanda have banned plastic bags.
There you go. And it's one of these things where really once people get over the initial shock, there's almost no, impact in their lives, and there's almost no economic impact whatsoever. And in the process of doing this, you eliminate, millions of tons of bags that might well end up either in landfills or in the ocean or just polluting one's city streets.
Laura, isn't there a film and bag federation that protects the interests of plastic bag makers?
Well, yeah, the Progressive Bag Alliance, I think they're called. And when they started seeing designer bags on the streets of New York City that said, "I am not a plastic bag," they got worried that a similar ban or tax would happen here in New York. So they took action, and they've actually been promoting some legislation that's been adopted both in New York City and several of the counties, and most recently the New York State Legislature. But that's a recycling bill. It's not. It really will not have anywhere nearly the effectiveness of the tax in reducing the plastic bag use to begin with.
So they are fighting back subtly against the switch to canvas bags that some people have been
Correct.
Making. In an article published in the New York Times in February, it was noted that in Ireland, carrying plastic bags became socially unacceptable, on a par with wearing a fur coat or not cleaning up after your dog. Is a place like Dublin the ideal place for such a trend to take hold? Alex?
Well, I think it's really difficult to make that kind of judgment because
well, it's Ireland, and we're talking green, aren't we?
Well, sure, and it's a fine place for the wearing of the green, but I think that what we really are finding out is that ecological concern is one of these things that, by and large, except here in the U.S., really transcends political boundaries, transcends cultural orientation, that people of all sorts of different stripes of belief recognize that we live on a finite planet and that we have to start taking real action to protect it.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, Laura, maybe you have an answer, is why some places and not other places?
Well, I think we have to start by saying what happened in Ireland began with a very solid policy that was made at the government level. The Irish environmental minister said, "We have to do something about this problem. Here's what we're going to do." And then it took hold in the public consciousness, and the fact that people actually felt badly being seen with a plastic bag. It remains to be seen whether that showed that they were very wasteful in their spending habits. They're willing to spend 15 cents for this plastic bag, or whether they're bad environmentalists. So, I think it starts with strong leadership. And that's exactly what we have lacking in the United States. In many cases, it is triggered by a need. And in some cases, it starts with a trend, and there's a lot of different people who want to see something done, and that gets something to happen. But I think that really you have to start with a policy.
Well, I was interested to note when I was in Aix-en-Provence when Europe was still affordable for an American, that older people tended to bring baskets or canvas bags to the market, and younger people just took the plastic bags when they bought. I mean, it was nice that they were all going to the green market, but there was definitely a generational change. And I would have thought it was the other way around, but we're really talking about traditions, aren't we, in some cases? Many people traditionally would never have taken a plastic bag.
Right.
Well, I think that's true. I think also, you know, there's really a major difference between Europe and America that's worth talking about, which is systems. You know, they are much more deeply engaged in making sure that their energy systems, that their production systems, you know, that their food systems are sustainable. And they have a real head start on us because they tend to live in compact communities and, you know, tend to already have lives which, at least materially, in terms of the number of things they have, are, you know, sort of less wasteful.
So, Laura, where does New York City stand in relation to its East Coast neighbors?
Well, in terms of the East Coast neighbors, you know, possibly ahead, you know, compared to the West Coast neighbors, we've got a long ways to go to catch up with them. But in New York, especially, you know, Mayor Bloomberg has done a lot, but also in the City Council, there's been, you know, a lot of good work done to pass good policies. And, you know, in the plastic bag, you know, bill is one example where, you know, I think they could have done a lot more, but
it requires stores that hand out plastic bags to take them back for recycling.
Right.
That really does not seem like a very drastic bill.
No, it's not. And when we have the evidence of how successful Ireland's tax is, it's very frustrating for groups such as mine when the politicians opt for the easier answer. When you've got the better solution is there, we know it works, and it could be done.
And what do the politicians tell you? Why are they resistant?
Well, let's see. You get different answers from different people and sometimes different answers from the same person on different days. But, you know, I think there, you know, certainly it's a step up from what we currently have. Most curbside recycling programs in New York, New York City included, don't take plastic bags. So for those of us who are environmentally motivated, you know, somehow even though I try not to take plastic bags, at the end of the week I end up having, you know, they're filling up my closet. It gives us an opportunity to take them someplace and get them recycled. So that's one of the answers, is it's better than nothing, which is true. And then there is some level of encouragement of reusable bags, because it also would require stores to sell reusable bags. So, I mean, it's that goes along the lines of, you know, it's an incremental change. It's a step in the right direction. Nobody would survive. Nobody could stand a tax. You know, God forbid we should put a tax on bags. But, you know, we really should. I mean, they're wasteful, and it would reduce their use and reduce the garbage and the litter and so forth.
But haven't we put a tax on bottles? And you've done a lot of work trying to update New York's bottle bill.
Well, that's another example. Actually, that's even less. That's a deposit. You put a 5-cent deposit on the bottle.
Yeah, but how many people actually go in and cash those deposits in?
I can't tell you how many people return their own bottles, but I can tell you that about statewide, the average is 70% of those bottles do get returned. So that's a huge return rate. It's much more successful than if you take a similar bottle, the water bottle, which doesn't have a deposit. Less than 20% of those end up in curbside recycling programs. So small as a nickel is, you know, it's such a tiny amount of money. It has had a huge difference. And in New York City, of course, you have, you know, a lot of large-scale collectors, building janitors, homeless people. You know, you've got a lot of, not necessarily homeless, but low-income people who are supplementing their income by collecting bottles and cans. So you do get a lot of these things returned.
What did you want to do to update the bottle bill?
Well, it was passed in 82, and that was, you know, before Snapple was invented, before, you know, bottled water was common. And now those beverage containers are, like, just soaring in comparison to soda sales, which are kind of flat, no pun intended. And so we want to just get that nickel deposit on those bottles and cans to make sure that most of them get recycled. And then the other part of it is the unclaimed deposits. And that's the other part of the Irish plastic bag tax, is those people who do pay the tax, that money goes to an environmental fund, and what we would have for the unclaimed deposits right now the bottlers keep them. This money would go to an environmental fund in New York to help support more recycling programs in parks and so forth.
I'm talking with Laura Haidt, who is a senior environmental associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group in Albany, where she directs their advocacy on solid waste, toxics, pesticides, and clean air and energy, and also with Alex Steffen, who's executive editor of worldchanging.com and editor of the book World Changing, A User's Guide for the 21st Century. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. During a fiscal crisis in 2002, Mayor Bloomberg cut back on the recycling program in New York City to save money. How much more does it cost to recycle than to throw everything away?
No, that was just a mistake. It was a terrible outcome, and the Independent Budget Office, you know, subsequently issued a report saying that New York City didn't save money when it suspended parts of the recycling program. So, I mean, there is an incremental additional cost. Recycling is still, even though New York City exports, you know, a great deal of its waste to Ohio and Pennsylvania and Virginia, they're still right now slightly more expensive, I think, per ton to recycle. But the more participation you have, the better bang for buck you get. And so we're getting to the tipping point where recycling really will be cheaper. And, of course, morally is the right thing to do. And when you look at the larger societal costs of, you know, of wasting energy and natural resources, you know, I think if you looked at the bigger picture, recycling is definitely the winner.
Alex, let's talk about composting. In San Francisco, recycling and composting are expected to be mandatory by the end of the year. What sort of infrastructure needs to be in place for something like that to work?
Well, essentially, you need two things. You need the collection system, and you need the composting system itself. You need a facility for turning the food waste and yard waste that people generate into soil. It's not really rocket science. It's pretty straightforward. There are difficulties involved, but it's not anything that pretty much any municipality couldn't figure out a way to do. And I think that it actually sort of touches on a larger question, which is how much is enough? There's a real debate going on at the moment about small steps and about how much effort should we be making to encourage people to take small steps, to make minor purchasing decisions, to, you know, perhaps go without some specific item that they might otherwise buy, like bottled water. And how much should we be actually talking with people about what we could do steps we can take that are actually larger and would make a big difference, you know? So we, for example, on World Changing, just covered recently Vancouver's efforts to move towards a zero-waste system, where basically they want to be, within the relatively near future, either recycling, composting, or reusing all of the waste that goes through their households, down to a very, very small percentage.
Well couldn't we do that? Right now we divide our garbage into garbage and paper and then also plastics and metals. Couldn't we also just divide the garbage into food scraps and coffee grinds and the like, and then other kinds of garbage as a fourth way of dividing up the garbage, and that would be compostable, wouldn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you could certainly do that. And, you know, there are some larger challenges with issues like what do you do with household appliances? And there are laws that can be passed that require the producers of those appliances to take them back at the end of their useful life, mm-hmm. Which tends to facilitate a very different form of manufacturing, one where disassembly and reuse and recycling of the component parts of those appliances is much more favored. So, you know, there are things that you can do that actually change the system as a whole. The problem is that usually what you need is a certain degree of political will to see systemic change. Often the changes pay for themselves over time, but the initial change itself is often very political, you know, and politically painful.
Can you describe the closed-loop composting system for restaurants in San Francisco?
I'm afraid I don't know that much about that specific.
Well, I've always been curious about the use of plastic bags to separate all of our garbage. Aren't the garbage bags, those plastic bags, not biodegradable?
You know, you ask an excellent question, which, you know, all of us who've been following New York City's recycling program over the years have been shaking our heads about. You know, it doesn't make sense. There's some real flaws with New York City's recycling program. And when we look, you know, maybe on the West Coast it doesn't look so great to you, Alex, but when we look out west, we see San Francisco and that three-cart recycling program they have. They put out three bins, a blue bin for recyclables, a green bin for compostables, and a black bin for garbage. Mm-hmm. And they've got a goal, which they're close to reaching, of 75% recycling and composting by 2010. You know, it literally makes us green with envy over here in New York.
In Europe as well. If you go to a public place, you'll see any number of different bins to throw your garbage into. It's just automatic. Why is it so difficult for us to do this? Is it because it requires different pickups?
Well, it is complex. In New York City, of course, you know, with the high-rise apartment buildings and the large office buildings, you know, it is a complex problem. But they were making steady progress with the recycling program. I think it does come around to political will. And, you know, when you think about it, back in 2002 when the city was facing a $5 billion deficit, and Mayor Bloomberg asked all of his departments to come up with an area that they could cut to save money. The Department of Sanitation, which has responsibility for the recycling program, said, let's cut the recycling program. Well, that tells you all you need to know about the political will, you know, at least at that time in that agency, to make recycling work.
So what do you think, Alex, is necessary to get people to be motivated? Is it that they have to be hit on their idealistic side or on the economic level?
Well, you know, I really think you can't separate the two. One of the things that's changed over the last several years is that we've really come to realize that the environment versus economy argument is a spurious one. It just doesn't matter. That you, in general, you can find ways of reaching almost any environmental goal you want to reach in ways that will actually perform economically. And there are so much low-hanging fruit in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of resource efficiency, in terms of urban planning and transportation, that we could, you know, get a great deal of the way towards, you know, carbon neutrality and towards zero-waste society and towards a society that's really just much more ecologically imbalanced at a profit. So part of what needs to happen, I think, is that we need to give people a sense of the magnitude of the challenge we face, because I think there are still a lot of people in the United States who don't recognize the extent of the problem and how dire a problem it really is. But also, I think, give people a sense that of the possible, you know, a sense that there are things that we can be doing as a society that will leave us better off as individuals, living in communities that are much nicer, and leaving a legacy for our kids and grandkids that's actually a habitable planet.
But so many of the things that we can do that will help the planet are more expensive, whether it's putting solar panels on our roofs, whether it's buying some of those organic soaps that cost about 10 times as much as Tide at the supermarket. Green products are really quite expensive. And
well,
I think that there's got to be a price resistance factor.
Well, and this is why it's not the right thing to do to privatize the responsibility for environmental issues. We can't put everything on the shoulders of consumers and citizens. That most of the things we really need to do are things we need to do together to change the systems in which we're involved. And we really just can't get there by, you know, having people buy their lavender organic bathroom soap. I mean, that may or may not be a great thing to do, but that won't solve the problem. Those kind of steps simply can't take us far enough. And we know that there are steps that are large steps, innovative steps, ambitious steps that are being taken all over the world that, if put together, would actually take us most of the way towards where we need to go, and many of them would actually make us money. So I think we have to change the debate about whose responsibility it is and what the responsibility requires us to do.
I'm talking with Alex Steffen, who's executive editor of worldchanging.com and also editor of a book called World Changing, A User's Guide for the 21st Century, published by Abrams. Also with Laura Haight, senior environmental associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group in Albany. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Thank you. And we're back with Alex Steffen of worldchanging.com and Laura Haight of the New York Public Interest Research Group talking about, I guess, the tipping points. For example, hybrid cars did not sell as well as they have recently because gas has become so expensive. Up until now, hybrids were kind of an elitist thing for people who could afford them. So do you think that that we have reached that tipping point, Alex?
Well, I think we're very close. I think we still have a very unrealistic debate happening politically in this country about what the environmental crisis demands of us and what kinds of responses are available to us. But I think that we are starting to see a real shift across the political spectrum, actually, towards ambitious thinking, towards big thinking, towards, you know, if you'll forgive me, world-changing thinking. You know, just today, T. Boone Pickens, the oil, you know, billionaire, announced his plan to generate 25% of the country's electricity with wind power from his new company. You know, we're starting to see people who are non-traditional allies really stepping up with plans that are bold and ambitious. I think what we need to add to that is a much more sophisticated debate about the kinds of innovation that are actually possible to us and the kinds of things that we can do in terms of the way we live that would make big differences. And those have to do with things like urban planning, transportation, food systems. You know, they're things that are often kind of boring. You know, they aren't a sexy piece of green furniture. You know, they're the fundamentals of how do we organize our society. But those fundamentals are really why we have, on average, an ecological footprint of five planets, meaning it would take five planets if everybody on the planet lived like we do, whereas Europeans often have an ecological footprint of 2.5 to 3 planets. And the difference between us is really almost entirely about those boring systems.
Well, how much of this should be put on the shoulders of individuals like you and me, replacing incandescent light bulbs for fluorescent light bulbs, getting a hybrid car and making sure that we only go shopping with a canvas bag? And how much of this is really the responsibility of government, which up until now has been rather resistant to imposing any real change?
I'd like to take a crack at that, if I may, and this has to do with the hybrid car issue. I mean, you're right that with the rising cost of gasoline, people are looking to smaller cars, more fuel-efficient cars. If we had better mass transportation alternatives, that would be what they'd be turning to right now. But the federal government's, our federal government's investment in mass transit is shockingly low in comparison to what they spend on roads and bridges and supporting the car infrastructure. So this is the time when more people would be taking public transportation, and a lot of them are, but the choices are still very slim, and this is a classic example where the government has failed us. And
up until recently, SUVs were subsidized, in effect.
Exactly. Yes, they were. The Humvee tax credit, which is, you know, again, was a shameful. You know, that was actually not a lack of leadership. That was just bad leadership.
So this is not even a Democrat-Republican problem, because we've seen people on both sides of the aisle vote in ways that would seem to be environmentally foolish because they're concerned about immediate economic impact in their areas. How do we get past that?
Well, I think go ahead, Alex.
Okay, I'll be brief. I just think that it really comes down largely to an issue of, let's say honesty in government. Because most of the time when we've seen foolish environmental choices made by elected bodies, they're made through the system of quid pro quos that happen when you have individual legislators backing specific business interests and, you know, sort of trading favors with one another. That really, when you get big public votes on important issues, you tend to get at least slightly smarter votes. And I think that there's a certain degree here where we need to all hold our elected officials more accountable and to a higher standard, and to sort of not accept anymore certain arguments, like the argument that that being more environmentally sustainable is going to hurt our economy. It won't. It's quite clear that the economy of the future is, you know, a clean energy, low toxic economy that, you know, our competitors in places like Japan and Europe and increasingly even in emerging nations are moving very, very swiftly towards that economy. And we're actually lagging. So these things are now hurting our competitiveness. And we can, I think, actually demand more of our electeds and demand more transparency about why they're proposing to make certain kinds of decisions.
Why has the West Coast been so far ahead in this regard? You're in Seattle. San Francisco has passed all sorts of laws. Los Angeles has as well. In fact, California passed a fuel emissions law that the federal government said it wouldn't recognize.
Well, I think some of it is cultural, that there's a real love of both the outdoors and of doing new things here on the West Coast in general. But I think there's also, at the risk of being ostracized by my neighbors, I think that some of that difference is overrated. Because while it's certainly true that new rules tend to be much more progressive here on the West Coast, we also have landform, you know, cities that are much more spread out, and we're much more reliant on the automobile. And we tend to actually have much higher rates of consumption of certain materials. And a lot of the benefit that we have in terms of things like our energy systems comes from decisions that were made long before there was an environmental component to them, like the creation of hydropower dams, which, you know, the reason Seattle's able to be so climate friendly is that we get most of our energy from a series of dams in the Cascade Mountains that were built, you know, 50 years ago or more.
Which were environmentally damaging.
Right. It's just that the damage has all been done, so we don't think about it. And so I think that there is a degree to which it's possible to sort of overstate the ecotopia aspect here. Now, that said, I think you do have a rare thing happening in California where you have a Republican governor and certain members of certain parts of the leadership of the Republican Party in California really having decided that they can run on green, you know, that this is an issue they care about, that they can do it just as well or better than the Democrats. And they're pushing hard, which has created an interesting sort of green arms race politically between the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of proposing better legislation and advocating for a stronger green economy. If we had that on a national scale, I think the nation would really benefit.
Now, Laura, you wanted to address some of these issues as well.
Well, just 2 points. One is that I think at the city level, New York City is doing great stuff and trying to do great, even more great stuff, but they're sometimes blocked at the state level, like the congestion pricing.
Although I have spoken to traffic experts who said that the problem with congestion pricing is that it wasn't thought all the way through and that it really did create a hardship for people who live in the outer boroughs who do not have adequate public transportation,
yeah.
And that if adjustments had been made that would have made it easier for them, then perhaps they would have been more amenable to it.
Well, in the end, gas prices seem to be succeeding in doing
yeah.
with congestion. We weren't able to do with congestion pricing. I'm not going to argue that point with you, but Gene Rushinoff from our Strap Hangers campaign worked very hard on trying to make that happen. And as you know, it didn't get through in Albany. But I couldn't agree more with Alex about the issue of honesty in government and needing to hold our elected officials to a higher standard. And I think, you know, we see environmental images everywhere, and a lot of it is in this consumer marketing, the green marketing. And a lot of people really are working very hard, and I think it's wonderful to make consumer choices that are cleaner and greener, that are going to make a difference for the planet. And they're doing it with the best of intentions. And I think it all adds up. But if I would just encourage people to spend, if they spend as much time hectoring their lawmakers, you know, just pounding their lawmakers, you know, on environmental issues, as they spend, you know, studying their consumer choices and making those choices, I think we'd see a lot of political change here.
Can you describe greenwashing?
Well, not all of it is greenwashing, but, you know, a lot of it might be. But you certainly see in ads, you know, well, here's a classic, you know, see a picture of a sparkling SUV in the middle of a rainforest, you know, featuring all its eco-friendly features. You know, that to me is greenwashing.
Yeah, when I see a huge car that says hybrid on it, I wonder what mixed message I'm getting from that.
Exactly.
But how many fluorescent light bulbs do we need to use before we make a real impact? And I just heard someone suggest that if we all declined to take the ATM receipt, we would save millions of trees. I don't know. That struck me as slightly ridiculous, but But
that's what I mean about time. If we spent the same amount of time, you know, writing letters to our legislators and trying to calculate these costs.
And how much electricity would we be using up when we send those email messages?
Right.
But in the end, if we all did take those little steps, as some have suggested, would it make a real difference?
Well, I think we have to take – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alex.
I was just going to say, I think that we definitely never want to discourage anyone from doing the right thing, right? That's not the point here. It's not like you should now suddenly throw every can and bottle you ever touch on the ground. But, you know, the point is that there's a certain, you know, there's a certain attention economy that everyone has. There's a certain amount of attention that we can spend on things. And we really ought to be spending that attention creating systems that take the problem of paying attention away from us. Right, there ought to just not be alternatives that we know are destructive to the planet and injurious to our national economy and national security. You know, we shouldn't have to choose between the good and the bad. We ought to get rid of the bad so that we can go about our lives being surrounded by things that, you know, that reflect our values.
Well, to some degree, this really, again, goes back to our legislators who would insist on cleaner factories, for example, because as much as I do in my house, it's just a spit in the ocean compared to the kind of polluting that I see sometimes just coming out of a chimney in a factory.
Right.
So is it really just a matter of legislators changing their attitude about all of this, thinking long term instead of short term?
I think it's everything, if I may. I think it's, you know, it's not just politics, although politics is vitally important. And there are a handful of laws that we could pass that already are in existence in other places around the world that would make a huge difference. And we could level the playing field, for example, in clean energy. We could do things like that that we already know we could do. But I think there's a wider societal shift towards, you know, really thinking of sustainability as the norm, you know, and thinking, recognizing that we live in kind of a crazy time where the idea that you could do something that's eating away at the very fabric of the planet is normal. And that's not going to be normal for very long. That idea of normal is already flying out through the window. And the sooner we can all, in whatever our walks of life are, start imagining ourselves living more sustainably, not just in our consumer choices, but in our jobs, in our community roles, you know, in the very fabric of our cities and towns, the better off we're going to be.
I sat next to a man who sold solar panels. He was a German salesman whose beat was Las Vegas, San Diego, and Los Angeles. And he said that if the German government was not subsidizing solar energy efforts, there would not be any solar energy efforts in Germany. Is that part of the problem as well, that we have to make that kind of commitment on a governmental level?
Well, there are a number of policy changes that we need to make, and we actually have a piece that's going to be running on World Changing tomorrow about energy policies that have managed to shift energy from fossil fuel sources to clean energy sources and how they've worked in different places. But there are a number of these things. We should have, for example, some sort of carbon pricing, some sort of cap and trade or carbon tax. That basically puts the cost of the things, of burning fossil fuel, for example, back on the shoulders of the people who are doing it rather than on the shoulders of everyone else on the planet. It internalizes, to use the jargon, an external cost. If we simply did that, if we simply got the prices right on a lot of the things that we're doing, we would actually be already in a position to make dramatic changes.
Well, that, again, would involve major commitment from legislators, from the federal government as well.
Yeah, and some leadership.
Is that likely?
Well, I think that's really, you know, that's sort of the that's the billion-dollar question right now. We don't really know. Certainly we have a slightly more sane debate on environmental issues and climate change than we've had for, you know, a decade or two, in that we have two candidates for president who both at least acknowledge that climate change is real and needs to be addressed. But I think there is still a real lack of reality or a real sense of irreality in D.C. about how far we have to go, how quickly, and how plausible that is. And, you know, that's really what's lacking is an understanding of just how possible building a sustainable future really is.
Laura, do you want to add? Because we're fast running out of time.
You know, lack of reality is alive and well in the state capital here in Albany. And what I see, you know, I agree with Alex, and I can just reinforce it, you know, a real disconnect between what people want, what the politicians are doing, and what the politicians think people can stand. I think that there's a very strong support for environmental protection, and you see that with people agonizing over their carbon footprints and, you know, looking at labels in the supermarkets, and yet, you know, in Albany, in D.C., most capitals, there's just undue influence by special interest business and businesses that would be, you know, perceive these policies as being detrimental.
Laura Haight is a senior environmental associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group in Albany, where she directs their advocacy on solid waste, toxics, pesticides, and clean air and energy. And Alex Steffen is the executive editor of worldchanging.com. You might want to check them out. Also the editor of the book, World Changing, A User's Guide to the 21st Century. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, New York Giants superstar wide receiver Plaxico Burress. Also, a look at the new action abstraction exhibit on Pollock de Kooning and the abstract expressionist movement. Sherman Alexie, Charles Burnett, and Milestone Films co-founder Dennis Doris on the restoration of the 1961 film The Exiles, plus the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeschick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Lauren Bonner, Judith Weber, Lawrence Holland, and Stephanie Hughes. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.